of the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. It is March the 9th, Monday, and we will be hearing from Rob Saxon again and his folks. Megan and also Iris is going to be presenting. Senator Thompson is excused. Senator Roblin will be late. Co-chair Comp will be late, and Rep Taylor is excused. I think that takes care of everybody. Mr. Saxon, welcome.
I want to open a public hearing on both those bills.
I will open a public hearing on House Bill 5016 and 5017. Drawn, sir.
Thank you. Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction.
A bright, sunny morning.
It's a beautiful day out and a beautiful weekend. I wanted to start today, if I could, by answering a couple of questions that were presented to us in our last session. One had to do with school buses and retrofitting of school buses. So we have on page one and part of top of page two, just about anything that you'd want to know about school buses and replacement. There were a couple things I thought were interesting about this. We have 5,800 school buses in the state. 2,500 of them were are newer than 2007, and 3,300 of them are prior to 2007. We've used tailpipe filters on about 600 of those that are older than 2007. It costs about $20,000 to put the tailpipe filter on, and then you also need to have a particulate cleaner for that tailpipe situation. It's about $75,000 for the cleaner. You just need one, and then you can clean multiple tailpipes, apparently. And we have the school district with the most old pre-2007 buses, the Salem Kaiser. They have 100, but they have a plan to replace 62 of them this year, which will be good. In 2007, we did get $1 million. It was eventually reduced to $800,000 with the recession to help with the replacement. Depending on how you went at that, if you did tailpipe filters, you could replace the tailpipes with that much money on about 80 or 40 buses. Or if you purchased new buses at $110,000 a piece, we could replace about 7 new buses. And so that gives some context for the question and maybe an idea about what that looks like. All the pre-2007 buses are required to be replaced by 2025 by state law. And I know there are a couple other questions that perhaps pertain more to Megan.
Thanks, Rob. Senator Monroe, members of the committee, there were two questions last week related to...
Yeah, who, Megan, tell us who you are.
Oh, for the record, I'm Megan Irwin, Acting Early Learning System Director at the Department of Education. There were two questions last week related to who we serve in the early learning system. Representative Springer had a question about the percentage of the under 5 population that we serve. With state-funded programs, we calculated those numbers, and it's 12.4% of the under 5 population served in our state-funded programs. And then there was a question about the percentage of eligible children we're serving in the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, and I reserved the right to fact-check myself on that, which we did. We serve 62.1% of the eligible population in the Oregon pre-kindergarten program. That's children at 100% of the federal poverty level or less, which leaves 37.9% unserved.
Okay. Questions on these items? When you're talking about school buses, something that I've been interested in for years that may someday happen is seat belts. And in fact, when I was on the board at David Douglas, I made sure that when we purchased buses, they were seatbelt ready, didn't have seatbelt ready, because I look forward to the day when we will have seatbelts on school buses. And I've heard many times from children that they have to buckle up when they're in the car, but it's kind of, I think, sending the wrong message when they're allowed to ride on our school buses without seatbelts. So I hope that'll happen someday in my lifetime. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Megan, just to clarify, so I understand. So of the 12% represents the students we are serving.
Chairman Rowe, Representative Springer, yes, that's correct.
And so then you talked about Early Head Start, some of those programs. That's in that 12%, or are we adding those two populations for?
That's Chairman Rowe, Representative Springer, that's inside that
12%. Thank you.
Yep. That's
what I thought. Wasn't very confident.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Saxon, and for the quick response to our questions.
My pleasure.
And why don't you go ahead and proceed? Tell us where we're at.
Okay. Well, I'm up today
to
finish the final third of the early learning presentation, and hopefully also give you the chance to hear from my colleague Iris Bell on the Youth Development Division's budget and work. So as the final third of my presentation, what I'm going to do is walk you through the programs that we actually run at the Early Learning Division in a little bit more detail, and talk to you about some of the key initiatives that we've been leading. So for 2015-17, our priorities really fall into three kinds of categories: support for families, investing in a cohesive system, and then connecting across systems. And we approached these priorities by thinking about strategies and areas where we could invest in systems building and innovation, like the Early Learning Hubs and the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, strategies for investing in programs in ways that build connections between parts of the system. One example of that is employment-related daycare, which we're not going to go into a lot of detail with this committee on. Another example of that is mixed delivery preschool, which I will go into some detail with this committee on. And then finally, we also looked to identify program areas where we believe that we do need to grow our current investment in order to provide intervention and support for families that's needed urgently as we're building these system connections. The program investment that we're recommending that my division runs directly is an investment in home visiting, and then the governor's requested budget also asked for an increase in early intervention, early childhood special ed, which is run out of the Office of Learning at the department.
How many school districts currently have programs for 3 and 4 year olds?
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, 52 school districts that we know of.
52 school districts?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's about a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Don't we have 197 school districts?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Sorry. Yes.
And just because of the wildly varying sizes of those districts, do you have any sense of about what percentage of, you know, of those, you know, is that about a quarter of the kids, or do you think it's more like two-thirds or one-tenth? Is it a bunch of tiny districts? Is it
Senator Monroe and Representative Smith-Warner, members of the committee, I think that's a really great question, and I think we have some data that we've collected on that. I wouldn't want to try to speculate on it right now. We'll just pull it up and bring it for you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question. So I wanted to start this section of the presentation with what's probably the most complicated piece to talk about, which is the early learning system building work. And so that means it's time to start unpacking the hubs. And, you know, we talk a lot about system building, and it's not just about changing how we do business in Salem. It's really about making a difference in the experience of children and families. And we believe that that can't happen at the state level unless we're also partnering with and empowering change at the ground level in the communities. And so that's what hubs are really all about. They're community-based and community-owned coordinators of early learning services. And they have some pretty big responsibilities. They're responsible, in a lot of cases, for working across geographies. They're also responsible for working across sectors. They're statutorily charged with bringing together K-12, health, human services, early learning, and the local business community. And the state and the Early Learning Council set clear parameters around the outcomes we expect them to achieve, and some guidance for how we want to see sectors and the people that work inside those sectors working together. But with the hubs, communities were given the flexibility to self-organize, to choose who runs each hub, and then to choose within their community the population of children that they most want to focus on. And while the idea of early learning hubs has been floating out there for about 4 years since the early learning reform conversation started, as real functional entities, they're very new. The legislation that created hubs was enacted in 2013. We had to go through a pretty intensive procurement process for them to be selected. And so the oldest hub has been in operation just about 11 months now. That's Early Learning Hub, Inc., which covers Marion and Polk County. And the youngest hub is that's under contract right now is Lynn Benton Lincoln, and we signed their contract 3 weeks ago. And then we still have three that we're still working with intensively to build them toward contract. And so I just kind of put that out there for folks to think about how new this system is as we look at where it's at in its development.
Do those hubs always involve parental involvement, parental members?
Chair Monroe, members of the committee, yes, that's actually a requirement that we put in the request for proposals, that parents would serve on the governing committee, so be part, have equal power in helping guide decisions. And then every hub has a parent advisory committee that they're working with. And one thing we want to push in the next biennium is making that even more meaningful, so that parents and the people who have the children who are most affected by the opportunity gap are really helping us make decisions about our strategies.
Good, that's very important. It's one of the great successes of Head Start is that they actively involve parents. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so one question I get asked a lot is, what is the actual job of a hub? And so to put it the most simply, their job from the state's perspective is to identify the population of children in their communities that are most at risk of arriving at kindergarten unprepared, and then to identify the needs of those children and their families, work across sectors, so health, human services, early ed, K-12, the private sector, to connect those children and families to services and supports that will meet their needs, and then to account for outcomes collectively across all of those sectors. So the job of the hub is not to provide service directly to families, but to connect families to the right services at the right time. And that means identifying gaps in services, working with partners to fill in those gaps. And for a lot of hubs, it's also meant identifying where there's a need, for example, a summer transition program that doesn't exist in their community, and then investing in making that program exist. So what that looks like looks different in each community across the state. But one thing that I think distinguishes our hubs from models like this that you see out in other parts of the country is that while the strategies that they use locally on the ground can differ, we're all shooting toward the same target. We have the same outcomes and the same focus that we're trying to move toward. We're pretty close to having hubs up and running across the entire state. Just an important thing for this committee to know, the legislature authorized the division and the council to have only 16 hubs. So that is another sort of distinguishing factor, something different from the previous system. We were allowed to launch 7 of those in the first year of the biennium and the rest in the second year of the biennium, which is another reason why you've seen this kind of staged launch that you've seen. For the communities that are not under contract yet, which is the North Coast, the Gorge, and the South Coast, we're providing really intensive support to those communities to help them sort of finalize their strategic thinking, finalize their collaborative work, and we're almost there. It's been nice to be able to work with them in this way, which we couldn't do during the competitive procurement process. And I think all three of those communities should be up and running and under contract within the next couple of months, or so my staff tell me. So as I mentioned, the hubs are developing strategies and approaches that meet the particular needs of their communities, but they're accountable to the same set of outcomes. We've spent a lot of work over the last 6 months really getting clear about what those outcomes mean, and determining short-term metrics and long-term metrics for understanding if we're making progress. So on the slide before you, you have the short-term metrics for school readiness and healthy, stable, and attached families. We've also identified indicators for a coordinated system, which are pretty processy, as well as medium and long-term metrics for all of these areas. So what you're looking at right now is what will be in their contracts for the next biennium. And because they're on what we think is probably a 5-year trajectory to actually change population level outcomes, we thought it was really important to have a list of pretty specific metrics that everyone is striving toward that incentivize the kind of collaboration that we want to see and the cross-sector focus on our target population, but still give them things that they can achieve in the next year or so as we're building toward seeing population level movement on things like the kindergarten assessment. And we think that what we really stayed focused on in developing the metrics where they're at right now is, again, things that the hubs can make an impact on right now that will make a difference for the children in the short term, and then staged out longer term indicators based on what the hubs are responsible for, but it just takes longer to impact. I wanted to spend a little bit of time with this group on the funding streams that exist for the hubs, because I think the level of investment that we ultimately put behind them will tell us how much of an impact we can make for our focus population or not. So the funding for the early learning hubs for the current biennium came from resources that previously went to the Commission on Children and Families. Some of the resources that previously went to the commission also went to the Youth Development Commission, and you'll hear Iris talk about that, and to the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund. So at this point, no new state general fund dollars have gone into this initiative. We had about $4.2 million in former commission funding to get the system standing up. It's one of those thin slices we looked at earlier. You see, and so that's where it says early learning hubs, $4 million. The family support dollars and the Great Start dollars are other former commission funds we were able to allocate to the hubs in the second year of this biennium. I just want to make a note on family support. We did inherit $3 million from the State Commission on Children and Families. $1 million of that was available to the hubs. The rest of that $3 million goes to our relief nurseries and our home visiting program, which we'll talk about in a second. And that family support money is federal money. It's not state general fund. So out of the about $4 million we had to launch the project, each hub received $50,000 in base funding and $15 per identified at-risk child under five. So we're not talking a lot of resource here. I've actually been pretty amazed at what they've been able to accomplish with a relatively limited amount of funding, the way they've been able to stretch that and use it to leverage other funding from other sectors, which I'll share a story about in a second. But I do want to say, I would be remiss if I didn't say, I don't think that the hubs can do everything that we've asked them to do or that statute calls upon them to do with this level of funding. And that's especially true if we're asking them to identify gaps in how the needs of their community are being met and then invest in filling those gaps. So the governor's requested budget asked for an increase for the early learning hub general fund dollars to $24 million for the biennium. That funding would go toward base coordination for the family resource management and navigation work that they're asked to do. It would also go toward making progress on those metrics and those outcomes. And then if we have anything left after we kind of allocate that out, the division would like to hold back a very small amount of money to do some work with smaller cohorts of hubs as they're working to solve some of the more complicated problems that the hubs are trying to solve that not everybody's going to be able to work on at the same time.
Representative Smith Warner.
Yes. Just a quick question on that. So would that allocation be between the 16 on a per capita, evenly divided,
that's a, et cetera? Yes, Senator Monroe, or Chair Monroe, Representative Smith Warner, that's a great question. So the base funding we would allocate per capita, I'd like to see $100,000 in base coordination for each fund for each hub for the biennium, so $50,000 a year, and then $30 per child, so that's doubling the 15 that they got per child. We allocate that out. There's the base that goes equally to everybody, and then we do it on a per-child allocation, not to go below 6,000 children. So we've learned with some of our rural hubs, for example, our hub that covers Harney and Grant counties, it's called the Frontier Hub. Their at-risk population is 795 children, and if we gave that, if we funded them at $50,000 plus $15 for each of those children, it's just not an amount that you can do anything with. And so we kind of figured out that 6,000 children is the floor to protect our rural partners from having to do something big with an absolutely insanely low allocation. And then for the funding to get to outcomes, we'll split that evenly, half for working toward kindergarten readiness, half toward working toward family stability. And the way that we handled it this time was the hubs proposed to us projects that they wanted to do and how much that cost, and then we had a negotiation process with them for how to allocate that funding out.
Thank you.
And did the co-chairs in their budget deal with the $24 million ask?
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, my understanding, and Doug just lowered his microphone so he may add to my understanding, is that this would come out of that $60 million pot that was allocated for strategic investments.
That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah.
There, Mr. Chair, there is the $4 million, or about $4.5 million, is in the base budget. So okay. The existing $4 million is in the base.
In the base budget, yeah, but
any increase will come out of the pot.
Increase would come out of that $60 million that's stretched pretty thin. Okay. I'm afraid of that. We have our job cut out for us. Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was one of my questions and fears at the same time. A few things, Megan. Number one, thank you for working hard to identify the frontier areas and really low-populated rural areas and their needs. I'm hoping that you're not going to go by way of I'm not going to look at Iris when I say this, but competitive grant kind of a situation for any of this stuff. And but my question really then would be, how does the $24 million ask compare to the funding that we were doing under the commission system to provide a lot of the same services?
Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, members of the committee, I anticipated that I might get this question. And so I tried to do a little bit of back of the envelope thinking about it with our fiscal policy analyst, and we'll have to get you more specific numbers if you want to include all of the funding that also used to go to activities that the Youth Development Division now runs. But when I added up just the dollars that used to go out into communities for services under the commission, it was just about $13 million, and then that doesn't include the basic capacity funding that they used to get to operate, because I just couldn't get my fingers on those numbers on Friday. So we're talking probably in the range of $13 to $20 million that used to go toward the commission system for early childhood services. And I knew we would get this question, and folks are already working on getting harder numbers to answer that.
Super. Thanks.
Well, it's going to be very important that you let us know if you only get, say, $13 million instead of 24, what does that do to your program? How much does it delay your program, and so on? How would you deal with a budget that only gave you, say, $13 million instead of 24? We need to know that. There's not enough money. We know that, and we're going to have to make decisions about prioritization of that thin $60 million.
Yes, Senator Monroe and members of the committee, I've actually been working on cost modeling that would show what would happen if we didn't do anything and then what would happen at different levels, and we'll be happy to share that with
you. That's what we need.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Huffman.
How many more people in the room have budgets that are going to come out of the 60? I'm just kind of curious. I invested in fairy dust over the weekend, by the way, so we can use some of that.
Yeah, well, we're going to need it. Okay.
So I expect that we'll probably do a whole day on the hubs where you'll get to hear even more details about the kinds of things that are happening at the community level. I do want to say, I think with an appropriate investment in them, what they can do will be just really interesting to watch. We're already seeing the fact that they exist as a way for them to leverage other funds in their community. I just learned last week that the Lynn Benton Lincoln Hub, which just got up and going, has already been able to receive a $300,000 investment from the health sector in their community to work toward their shared goals around children's health and developmental screening, something that wouldn't have come toward early childhood in that community if the hub didn't exist as that organizing body. And I can give all kinds of examples, which I won't in the interest of time today. But I think it'll be really interesting for you to get to hear more about what they're actually doing on the ground. Another area where we're also making just real strides in early learning is on the connection to K-12 side. So in addition to the initiatives that you see on this slide, the Early Learning Division and ODE are working together on the Age 3 to Grade 3 initiative, which you heard a lot about. And we have already started the work to convene stakeholders to do that early learning standards alignment work across that continuum. One of the main ways that we've been strengthening our connection between early learning and K-12 is through this fund. This is the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, also created in 2013 out of dollars that previously went to the Commission on Children and Families. And these dollars are used to support elementary schools and early learning providers to work together on a couple of key things, aligning instructional practices, engaging parents as partners, shared professional development, and transitions to kindergarten. So that should sound pretty familiar. This is one of the key ways where we learned about what works in connecting the early grades to early childhood, and you see that now reflected in some of our work on the literacy initiative. We were able to fund 16 programs out of this allocation, and we're now benefiting more than 9,000 children. And this is an initiative that I think is really interesting just to think about as a committee, because while most of our initiatives have been funded less than a year, this is one where we're already seeing really good results. Preliminary data is showing that that the program is reducing risk factors exhibited by children who participate, increasing parent knowledge and confidence in supporting their children, and increasing performance among participants on the kindergarten assessment compared to peers in their service area and peers at the state level. And we're seeing those results in a variety of our programs. One of the places where we're seeing the strongest results is actually out east in rural Oregon through the Eastern Oregon Community Services Hub. So this program was created out of $4 million of former commission funds. It's a great example of repurposing existing resources to get stronger results. And we're asking for a $5 million increase in the governor's requested budget to this program. Okay, staying at the systems level, one of the largest parts of our state's early learning system is childcare. And the Early Learning Division is responsible for ensuring the health and safety of children in licensed care. So this includes care for children before they get to kindergarten, and then also for children in before and after school care, because our federal funding stream funds us to do that work up to children who are age 12. It's a really small part of our work that we do, but important for you to know about. On the licensing and regulatory side, we kind of think of ourselves as a consumer protection agency when it comes to parents in this area, because we do the monitoring of nearly 4,300 childcare facilities, so that if you send your child to a licensed facility, you know that it meets basic health and safety requirements, and that that provider has, and the other adults in the home have passed a background check. In addition to ensuring that basic health and safety standards are met, we're also really working to work with providers to offer environments and experiences in their program that promote positive child development and contribute to school readiness. So all of that work includes the early childhood professional development system that we run, which is both in-service training and then a lot of work that we're doing to help childcare providers receive their degrees. It includes a childcare resource and referral network, which, in addition to helping parents connect to childcare when they need it, also offers technical assistance and training to childcare providers in their community. And then the biggest is the quality rating improvement system, which is our way of actually getting childcare kind of on the grid and measuring where providers are at in terms of their commitment to quality and then their meeting of quality standards, which have to do with how much learning and child development is actually happening in their program. Childcare providers are also, for the most part, small businesses, and so we also think of our work as doing an important part to support the local economy in a lot of parts of our state.
Do we know what percentage of childcare early childcare providers are licensed?
Yes, actually, Chairman Rowe and members of the committee, this slide actually shows you where children are in the state in terms of formal and informal care and with parents only. So you can see that close to 60% of the children under the age of 5 are in some kind of formal or informal out-of-home care setting. And we know that the experiences that children are having in these settings has a real impact on their learning and development. We also know that learning can happen in a lot of places. So it can happen at home with parents, absolutely. It can happen in a family care program, a Head Start, a preschool, an informal setting. Our goal as a division is wherever our staff are touching a child care provider, wherever we're investing state funds in child care, we really want to be working to raise the level of quality there. In terms of the breakdown percentage of providers, I can get you what will be, again, kind of an estimated number. We know the number of people who have licenses, and we know the number of people who are providing care who are receiving subsidy. That's kind of the informal setting. And so I can give you the comparison between those two, but there's no way to know every person out there that might be taking care of a child, because yep. if they're not licensed and they don't receive subsidy, we don't have a way of knowing who they are.
Yep.
This slide just gives you a sense of where the Office of Child Care Resources are at. But to get a real sense of what that means, we really need to look at this slide. Almost all of the funding for the Office of Child Care is federal. It comes from the Federal Child Care Development Fund. And almost all of that funding, about 81%, we send over to the Department of Human Services to run the employment-related daycare program, which are child care subsidies for low-income families. CCDF requires states to spend 70% of their CCDF allocation on subsidies. So in Oregon, we actually substantially exceed that requirement. And then the rest of our CCDF allocation comes to the division, that 6.1% slice that you see there, that is the Office of Child Care. That is our monitoring and our licensing and our background check work. And then the quality supports that you see there, that is that professional development system, et cetera, that I showed you on that last slide. In the interest of time, I'm gonna actually not spend very much time on employment-related daycare, because that policy work really winds its way through the Human Services Committee, and I really want Iris to have a chance to talk today. I am happy to answer questions about it if there are any, but the main thing I want you to know is that we receive and spend a substantial amount of funding on child care subsidies that we pass through to the Department of Human Services. And there's a bill up in House Bill 2015, in Human Services, House Bill 2015, that would let us take that even further. Like all federal funding streams, CCDF comes with a number of rules and requirements. And those rules and requirements just changed. Last fall, the Congress passed the reauthorization of this fund. And the reauthorization really strengthens the focus of CCDF on promoting positive child development, and that really affirmed work that we do in Oregon already, but it also added some new requirements, the most significant of which is a new requirement that will require my office to monitor license-exempt providers who receive ERDC payments. This would add about 3,000 to 5,000 facilities to our caseload, and so that is a pressure on how we slice that pie up that I want this committee to be aware of, because we're gonna have to talk about that when we get to actually what our legislatively approved budget is.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Can I just ask briefly, licensed exempt? Could you explain what that
is? Yes.
That seems a little bit like an oxymoron.
Yes,
so.
Senator, or Chair Monroe, Representative Smith-Warner, these are folks that still have to do some sort of minimal background checking. They have to get CPR and first aid trained. They can only care for up to 3 children, but they can receive a child care subsidy. So this is basically very small in-home family care, like I need child care, you're my neighbor, can you watch my child? You can get a subsidy, and then you get some sort of minimal support from the state to do that. So we don't license everybody who receives a child care subsidy in this state. This slide just looks at some of the outcomes that we really work toward with our child care licensing and our employment-related daycare system. And this one just shows you the history of funding for the Office of Child Care. All right. So in addition to licensing and supporting childcare, the division also directly administers early learning programs. I'm gonna walk you through what those are as quickly as I can. The largest one, if you remember back that pie chart on the first day, employment-related daycare was one big slice. The Oregon pre-kindergarten program is the other big slice. So that's the largest program that we run. It serves 3- and 4-year-olds who live in poverty, and it works side by side with the federal Head Start program. Most programs in our state receive federal and state dollars. The federal dollars go directly to the programs as grantees. They do not pass through the state, so they're not part of our budget request to you. And sometimes folks don't fully know or understand this. So basically, when we're talking about Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start, it's because our Oregon Pre-Kindergarten grantees are exactly the same as the federal Head Start grantees, with the exception of seven programs which are OPK only, but follow the Head Start performance standards to the letter. The program currently serves 13,762 children. That includes, that's with the blend of state and federal funding. That is 62% of the eligible population. And again, that's 3- and 4-year-olds living in poverty, as well as some children with disabilities who are over the income limit, and children who are in foster care. And if you look at the funding history of this program, you can see that we've made some pretty significant investments in preschool in the last decade. Because of the Great Recession and the increase of the number of children living in poverty, though, these investments have not kept up with increased need. Actually, before the recession, the percent of eligible children served was going down even as the number of children was going up.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Megan, the CSL for 15-17 represents kind of a status quo with the 62%.
Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, that's correct. So our proposed budget, the governor's recommended budget for 15-17, does request an increase in funding for preschool, but it requests that funding in a different way than we've previously invested in preschool. The governor's requested budget asks for a $30 million investment out of that 60 in mixed delivery, in a mixed delivery model. And so we've really done this as a collaboration between early learning hubs, Head Start, child care programs, and community-based organizations who would all have access to this money to add slots to their programs that would be state-funded. And so for the first time, we would be investing state preschool dollars in school districts that want to have a preschool program, in high-quality child care, and in community-based programs, in addition to investing in the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten program. The Oregon Head Start Association and the Children's Institute have really demonstrated a lot of leadership in crafting the policy around this piece of legislation and its associated investment, and we're pretty excited about what it could look like. This investment would also allow us to serve children up to 200% of the federal poverty level who do not currently have access to preschool programs. There are currently 1,873 children on the OPK wait lists, and this investment level, if we were at the Oregon pre-kindergarten cost per child, would allow us to serve 1,700 of them. Okay, moving to the earlier side of early learning, we also administer Healthy Families Oregon, which is a home visiting program for at-risk children, and it serves women prenatally until their children turn 3 years old. It's part of a national evidence-based Healthy Families America program that's demonstrated to increase parent skills, promotes positive parenting practices that support school readiness, and then really importantly with this program, there's a strong evidence base that it reduces child maltreatment. So,
this is for women of poverty?
Chair Monroe, members of the committee, many of the women we serve in this program are women who live in poverty. However, since part of the program focuses on reducing child maltreatment, we also serve women who are experiencing postpartum depression and other risk factors similar to that, and you don't have to be poor to be experiencing that. Yeah. So this does serve people above the poverty level if they demonstrate enough risk factors to indicate that they would benefit from this program.
And domestic violence come in play at all?
Yes.
Okay.
So currently we're serving 2,470 at-risk families who are receiving home visiting and parental coaching. And in 2013, the legislature expanded eligibility for the program from only being able to receive it on your first birth to being able to receive it with subsequent births, but didn't increase funding for the program. In the past biennium, there were about 1,100 families who were screened, determined eligible for the program, and wanted it. It's an optional program, but we couldn't serve them because of lack of funding. So there is $10 million in the governor's requested budget to increase the service level for this program to help address that gap and to allow us to expand our outreach to serve families who have had subsequent births. This is one of those services. I actually think the demand for the program might be higher than that. It's one of those services where we don't always market it as robustly as we could, because we know that the demand outstrips the available funding, and it the worst thing is to tell somebody you could have this thing, but you can't because we don't have a slot for you.
So you're going to have a number of women that, first of all, are not aware of the program, maybe need it the worst, or are afraid of anything that has to do with the government, so they don't ask for it. Okay.
This just takes a look at the outcomes that the program gets. It gets really great results. This is really an investment in prevention. Children who are served by this program are 2.5 times less likely to be maltreated than unserved children. Parents in the program are less stressed out. They read to their children more often. And these are the kinds of changes that we really need to see if we're going to reach our goals around healthy, stable, and attached families. And I also think our goals around kindergarten readiness. And this is one of the few investments that the division runs that really is targeted at that birth to three population. And then this just shows, again, funding history. The program gets great results for folks that have access to it, but we haven't really increased our investment in it in a number of years, even as we've expanded eligibility. Staying on prevention, the Relief Nursery Network is also a really fabulous upstream investment in prevention. Relief nurseries work with families and children under the age of 6, where the family has risk factors, again, associated with child maltreatment. And the goal of the relief nurseries is to keep children safely in their homes and reduce foster care placement. It works with families experiencing multiple sources of stress, and so it's a pretty intensive model. We serve 3,300 children in the relief nurseries, and that might seem like kind of a small number for the network, but they really focus on some of the most at-risk children, and it's just so intensive that that's actually an appropriate number of kids for them to be serving with the funding they currently have. Because of the intensive work that they do, you can see the great results that they get. They significantly reduce the number of stressors and risk factors that families are experiencing. They keep almost every family that they work with intact. And they also build some of those parenting skills that help children be ready when it's time for school. The legislature did make a pretty significant investment in the relief nurseries in terms of an increase for the biennium that we're in right now. So for the next biennium, because there's another couple of programs we need to focus on, the governor's requested budget requested current service level for this network. This is my last slide, in case people were starting to wonder, when is she going to wind down? This is the last program that we administer directly. It's a very small investment in Early Head Start. Early Head Start, as the name suggests, is the companion to Head Start. It's for younger children, so again, children in that 0 to 3 range. Prenatal moms who are living in poverty are eligible to enroll in the program, and then their children can start to participate until they turn 3, and then they graduate into Head Start. Our state's investment is, again, small. It serves 64 children, and is supplemental to a much larger investment from the federal government. Between the state and federal funding that we receive in Oregon, we reach about 6% of eligible children in this program. And Early Head Start has both home-based and center-based models, and the federal government actually just did some expansion grants to help Early Head Start partner with childcare in a stronger way, which is kind of interesting to watch. And because it's a full-year program and it works with younger children, it has a higher cost per child than the Head Start for 3 and 4 year olds. So the cost per child in this program is about $11,000 a year. And the governor's requested budget proposed increasing the program by $4.1 million.
Okay.
That's all I've got for today. I look forward to another opportunity to come back and go even deeper into some of the proposed investments and think about how might we prioritize some of them, since it exceeds that $60 million amount.
Oh, you'll be back. But, We're just getting started.
Yeah. But thank you so much for your really thoughtful questions, and I'm happy to turn things over to Iris now.
Thank you very much, and let's hear from Iris.
Welcome.
Thank you, thank you. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm Director of Youth Development Council. I'm going to give you a brief sort of history, most of you know, of the council, and then I'll move a little bit into the programs that we're actually funding, the investments that we're making in the community, and then share with you a bit of our budget and where we were, where we are, and where we're trying to go as we move forward. So I guess I need to. So, as you know, the Youth Development Council was created and established out of House Bill 4165, and this is the council, to support the Oregon Education Investment Board and support the board in terms of academic success, reducing juvenile criminal activity, and doing so in a way that was measurable and accountable. So, in 2013, in House Bill 3231, the Youth Development Division was created within the Department of Education. Now, in this next slide, it talks about 21 members of the council, and it talks about at least 15 members of those council and the director being appointed by the governor. So this is a little bit dicey here. So actually, all 21 members of the council are appointed by the governor. This 15 has to do with our requirement under the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to create a state advisory group. They call them SAGs. Every state has a SAG, and every state has to have at least 15 members. We then have 21 members that serve as the state advisory group. So all of them are appointed, all of them basically serve, but our minimum for that state advisory group is that 15. So that's the 15 piece in there. So the focus of the Youth Development Council has been on the age group of 6 to 20, and that's right out of our legislation. We really are focused on opportunity youth and priority youth, and I'll get a little bit more into detail on that and how we came to be focused on opportunity and priority youth. But this is a group of young people, these young people, who are experiencing barriers to learning, barriers to career, barriers to workforce. Many of them are not connected to school or to work. And so given that, the Youth Development Council has really focused and targeted its attention on those young people. So one of the things that happened, and we too came out of that old commission system, and our funding, as Megan mentioned, was sort of divided up. And so some of that funding, a majority of it that had to do with early childhood, went to Megan's program, Early Learning Council. And then some of that funding went over to the Youth Development Council. Now, the funding that went to the Youth Development Council primarily was the federal funding. So the majority of our funds right now are our Title 20 Social Service Block Grant funds. And those come right out of the federal government. And then we have some funds, and I'm going to get more in detail on this, but it's going to sort of lead to how we came up with this new allocation plan. So then we have some funds that are state funds. So now what happened out of 3231, out of that House bill, in terms of, in addition to creating our division, we were also sort of mandated to create a new funding allocation plan. How were we going to distribute these funds that were from the old commission system, and what was that going to look like? Well, given that we had a new age range, 6 to 20, now the old commission system was 0 to 17. So given that we were now given, in this new legislation, a new age range, we needed to kind of figure out how we were actually going to make the investments from those small funds that we had out into the community. And so part of the thing, another thing that we were kind of charged with doing was going out into the community, engaging the community, and having conversations about how these funds might be funded, might be distributed in the future. And so we kind of held over like 100 meetings. We went to about 30 different communities. And what happened as a result of that was something called our community investment strategy. Now that strategy was based on a few different things. Because we had such sort of meager funds, we knew we had to focus and target them. So the first thing that the council did was say that we need to take a look at indicators of need. What are the needs and who are the most neediest in these communities that we visited, and we really heard from some of the most neediest individuals. They wanted to make sure that the funds that we were going to invest were invested equitably in those communities. And because, again, the funds were so small, we knew that given the number of folks in communities, community-based programs, school districts, ESDs that might seek our funding, that we had to come up with some sort of methodology that would not have individuals seeking this funding, but collective groups seeking the funding. So we used what is called the collective impact methodology to actually look at how we might do this. Now, that methodology says that communities can come together and they can look at a common agenda. What is the common need or concern that they want to address in their community? They can look at how they're going to be communicating that collectively so that there's not mixed messaging going on about what that need is. And then they can look at the kinds of activities that they can do in a mutually reinforcing way. In other words, we're all going to go out, if our aim is on absenteeism, we're all going to go out collectively. We're going to communicate that aim collectively. We're going to take a look at the kinds of activities that support school attendance collectively instead of having the Boys and Girls Club or different organizations doing different things. They would collectively come together to do that. And then in the end, they would have shared measurements. So we wouldn't have one of the complaints that we heard over and over again from many of the community-based organizations is that everyone was requiring a different set of measurements, a different set of reporting activities, so that there was this really different set of guidelines that they were getting from all of these different agencies. So this collective methodology said, with our funds, which were so meager, that they could come together in a shared way and deal with them. So based on that, we looked at need, we looked at performance, and we came up with these different approaches. So now you see we have this four grant streams, which is what the council recommended that we do. A youth and community grant, which had three tiers to it. A youth and innovation grant, which is a different kind of grant, which targets emergent need, one-time only kinds of things. One of the things we heard in community when we went out was we'd hear a group of parents and a group of community folks say, if only we could do this with some funding. Because most of the funding was restricted. It had certain things you could and could not do with it. And they go, if only we could do this one thing. If only we could buy these books. But we can't buy these books with the monies that we have. So we heard that over and over again about how that could strengthen their approach to supporting these young folks. And so the council then created this Youth and Innovation Grant, which is part of our grant process. And then youth and gangs. And so this youth and gangs piece was a piece put together. The governor Kitzhaber put an extra or additional, well, not additional, $1 million in our budget and said, start to try and impact the gangs in some way. And of course, many folks were looking at this as a metropolitan area issue, but there are gangs all over the state of Oregon, as far east as Malheur County, as far south as Jackson County, up the basin, and in central Oregon as well. And so part of what we did was to work with those particular communities that could prove that they had a gang methodology and a gang model to begin to take a look at how we could support some of the activities that were going on in their communities. And then finally, we have this youth and juvenile crime prevention piece. And this is, again, these are our federal funds. And so the federal funds were put into the pot with respect to the grants. And so we had these four grant streams that we were funding. So let me talk a little bit more about the Youth and Community Grant. Again, this is a grant for kids from 6 to 20, and it has to be evidence-based, or it has to be research-based, and it has to actually have, or practice-based, because many of the tribal communities that we engaged spoke of their practice-based approach. And so, again, three tiers were available with respect for the funding for this particular group. Then our youth and innovation, I spoke to you about that a bit. Again, much more targeted, much more focused much more directed at a particular emergent need or a one-time only scalable, let's get it to scale type of a project. So that was our second one. And then again, youth and gangs. Now here's where any particular program that sought this particular funding had to use the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention's comprehensive gang model. So you couldn't just say, oh, you know, we think we have gangs in our school because kids are having some fights in the afternoon on the playground. You had to have this sort of demonstrated process, which had to do with a community that had come together, that you had sort of like police records and information, that you had valid information that actually said you did have a gang problem in your community. And then those activities had to be focused and directed on gang-affected or gang-involved young people. And finally, our youth and crime prevention funds, which are our federal funds, again, sort of mandated by the federal government. These were specific programs that needed to be addressed. So you had your disproportionate minority contact reduction project, and that had to do with the fact that in many, many states across the country, and Oregon as well, there's a disproportionate number of young kids of color who are coming in contact with police departments and sheriff's offices. And the question then becomes, how do you start to sort of mitigate that? What's happening there? Let's take a look at that. And there's a whole process of how you go about beginning to determine what those particular, who those counties are that have the problem and how they resolve it. And then there's the restorative justice piece, which looks at you know, criminal behavior in young people, but also looks at their positive their positive behaviors as well, and then looks at things like restitution, peer courts. How do young people themselves engage in a process of restoring justice in their communities? And then, of course, there's a gang reduction piece at the federal level that we deal with. And then our crossover practice model. Now, this piece of what we're being asked to do at the federal level has to do with our foster care programs and the fact that many of our foster youth end up in our criminal justice system. And so there's some funding given to each state if indeed they choose to look at this crossover youth population to begin to address how that is happening. So we work with DHS and we work with communities that are looking at this problem, and we have several counties right at this point who are involved in looking at our crossover youth programs. Now, I'm not going to go into this in any detail, this particular chart. We ran out of time, so we weren't able to make it nice and graphically pleasing to you.
Oops. Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Iris, it's nice to see you.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, and just like, how are you, what steps are you taking for students that are in Hillcrest and McLaren?
Senator Monroe, representative, COP members of the committee, we work with OYA in terms of working with youth who are in Hillcrest and McLaren, and we have a young person who actually is in McLaren who's on the council itself. And so part of what we're doing is trying to engage and look at how, as those young people come back into the community, as they transition out of those institutions, where are they in terms of their academic and career development, and what are we doing while they're in those institutions towards their academic and career development. So we're working closely with OYA on some of those pieces, and then our JCP, our juvenile justice, our juvenile crime prevention piece, also works with those young folks as well.
Mr. Chair, may I comment? The last few times that I've been to McLaren, I've just been really impressed with, there's just a difference in the climate and the culture in the building. You can tell that the young people are engaged, and yeah, there's not a feeling of tensions and all those markers that you can sometimes find in those environments.
Chair Monroe, Chair Kump, members of the committee. One of the things that we know that's happening at OYA is they're using a restorative justice approach, a reformation, a youth reformation approach. And so this, the idea that young folks can reform their lives and can get back on track and to support that activity while they're at McLaren and Hillcrest and then continue to support that activity as they come out is a really a switch from really looking at sort of the criminalization of these young people and trying to take a look at youth reformation and how they are reformed and how they come back into the community ready to support and work towards positive goals. So that is indeed what the folks at OYA are doing, and it's something that we actually at the council support.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So again, this particular slide, again, we weren't able to get it to be graphically pleasing, but what we wanted to demonstrate here is what we're requiring of the folks who actually receive the funds and where we make the investment. So what you see here is our inputs, our outputs, our short, medium, and long-term goals. And for example, when we talk about the inputs, we want to know from a community, who are you going to serve? And they may tell us, we're going to serve 20 girls in a program that's going to build their self-esteem. And then we want to know, how is that going to relate to supporting their academic or career success? So every step of the way, we sit down and we negotiate with the folks who receive our funds to find out what they're going to do along this particular trajectory to support the young people in the community. And so we'll hear 50 young people we're going to do this with, or, you know, we're going to do an attendance project with 100 young people, and here's what our goals and objectives are going to be. Here are the outcomes that we're going to try and measure, and here's how we're going to try to take a look at that as it relates all the way to that long-term goal of 40-40-20. So we've said to each one of these individuals, each one of these organizations in the community, you have to link your activities towards the direction in which we are headed, which is 40-40-20. Can't sort of be off doing something that could be positive and could really be supportive, but doesn't sort of reflect those particular goals. And so for each, we sit down, we go through this sort of process with them, and we talk about what it means to receive our investment and what that means to stay on track towards moving the dial with respect to these particular young people. And then this is the same for our juvenile crime prevention funds as well. And we've tried to link our federal funds to this as much as we possibly can, you know, although the federal requirements are a bit different. So let's talk a little bit about our state juvenile crime prevention program. And the reason we are is because a significant portion of the funds that we have are state general funds that go towards juvenile crime prevention. And what happens here is the idea of reducing juvenile crime and recidivism, and our recidivism rates, and trying to measure what's happening with these particular young people. And so they have these risk factors that we take a look at in this program. It has to do with school failure, antisocial behavior, negative peer association, poor family functioning, and substance abuse. And so the programs that receive these funds, which are our county programs, so all 36 counties and 9 federally recognized tribes receive juvenile crime prevention funding. And so they receive these funds, and they are then to impact these particular risk factors in their communities and address them based on what they see happening in their communities. Now, the kinds of programs that they use to address these are the same kinds of programs that we find that we were trying to address in our Youth and Community, Youth and Innovation grants. So they're looking at school-based services. They're looking at family support services. They do have teen and peer courts that are funded. Then there's education and skill building, behavioral health, and mentoring. So all of these kinds of activities are based in community, and the juvenile crime prevention programs support them through the funds they receive from the state funds. And so here's sort of that breakdown again of the general fund into the types of funding that is that takes place with respect to those areas that you saw on the other page there. And so, and then here's another sort of breakdown of the federal funds. As I talked about the crossover youth, the restorative justice programs, the DMC, disproportionate minority contact, and then the tribal best practices. This is a breakdown of how we use those federal funds with respect to juvenile crime prevention. So community schools. Now, this is, an area where, when you go back to the old commission system, the legislature, a few years before the commission system was abolished, identified community schools as one of the areas that they wanted to begin to make investments in. And so they made a small investment of about $200,000 towards the development of community schools. And five community schools were developed as a result of that investment. And basically, they were programs that school-based programs that were for like before and after school programs that had nutrition programs associated with them. They had parent and community engagement in them, and they had basic support services. These were for young kids in the mornings, before school, after school, to support what was going on and to enrich those communities. So we have five sites that still exist right now. This particular picture here that you see is actually Mid Valley Elementary School in Hood River. So this is a real community school in action here, where folks are helping to engage young people. So now let's talk a little bit about the division itself. The division itself supports the work of the council. I'm in legislation as being the administrator for the council. And so we have a very, very small staff that supports the 21-member council itself. And we do a lot of the monitoring and the accountability. We do much of the fiscal reporting, all the things that help to support the direction that the council is working towards, which is this whole idea of making these investments in communities where they see this need and where they're looking at equity. And so here's another way of kind of looking at how these funds are in our budget for distribution. When you take a look at each of the particular categories, again, our youth and community investment is mostly out of our Title 20 federal funds, and the largest significant portion of the funds that we have that are state-generated funds come from go to our juvenile crime prevention program. And then this is another sort of look at our current service level. Again, you see the largest.
Madam Co-Chair.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, when we look at the, like, the $20.7 million all funds, is that current, I always forget the terminology, but that's just the same budget as last time, or is that a roll-up? Current service level.
Madam Chair, the 20.7, I believe, in this case, is the 13-15 budget. This division's budget is basically rolled up using the standard current service level calculations in terms of current service level, and had only a slight enhancement in the governor's proposed budget.
Right.
Thank you.
And you'll see that in this particular slide. Well, yeah, in this particular slide where you see 23.2. And then this is another way of kind of taking a look at how our funds are distributed, both with our federal funds and our general funds. And you'll see where our little community schools have a very, very little funding there. And again, you'll see that this most significant portion of our funding is our juvenile crime prevention. But you'll see that what we're trying to do and what the council is trying to do is to actually build that youth and community grant and to extend it so that it reaches further into the community and can support community-based programs.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this come out of the 60 also?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, this, like I said before, there's very small enhancement in this budget, so I think it's like less than $1 million would be tied to that $60 million for enhancement. The rest would be in the base budget.
Right. So, co-chairs Monroe and Comp and members of the committee, so basically what we're saying is in this particular budget, we have no additional funds. So they'll be the same funds that we've had the last time. And so finally, with our last slide here, you basically see how that sort of plays out with respect to our personal services, our services and supplies, and our special payments. Almost all of our funds go out to the community in special payments, and we're going to continue to try and do that. And any enhancement, again, I understand the notion of the $60 million, but what we're trying to do is build our capacity to support those young people who are both neither in school or working or potentially on their way to being in that situation. I firmly believe that we need to be able to support these young people too, and that's not something that we've put a lot of money towards.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. And, you know, even though it's a million, I'm trying to, I'd like for the committee and the audience to be able to hear what all will have to come out of that 60. And even though that million is the smallest number we've heard to come out of that, I think, because I'm having meetings daily with folks presenting programs that I'm finding out have to come out of the 60, and it's getting to be kind of scary. So I just would like for us to be able to point out everything that is intended to come out of that.
Yeah, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, probably later this week, probably after public testimony, we're developing a table that will walk through of the state resources, not the federal, but the state resources that are in the base as well as which are proposed in the governor's budget to come out of the $60 million pot.
Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah. Well, with that, I conclude my presentation to you. Thank you.
Are there questions for Iris? Thank you very much. Rob?
Moving on to state school.
You have 10 minutes.
I'm not Mr. Chair, the next, other than maybe a couple slides before, jump right into the state school fund, and you have about 5 minutes left. I'm not sure that it would be worth.
Are we supposed to hear from DAS?
Actually, that is later on in the presentation. You still have a large share of ODE's budget to go through, and all the K through 12 grant and aid programs, which are hundreds of millions of dollars also.
And tomorrow we have public testimony in hearing room E.
I'm looking at Julie to make sure it's E tomorrow.
E.
At 8:30, and then that'll continue on Wednesday.
If need be, and then if not, Mr. Saxton can start with, I guess, the state school fund presentation.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
We only have 132 slides left.
Is that all?
Mm-hmm.
We've crossed the halfway mark.
Correct.
In a week. And yeah, a question for Doug. I guess we can't anticipate how many people will want to testify, but are we going to have our little clock available if need be?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I plan to set up the stoplight.
Okay.
If there's lots of people, we will use it and generally try to keep things to three minutes. But if there are 400 people, then we have a larger problem.
Thank you. I just wanted to.
And Madam Co-Chair will be chairing tomorrow.
And I will be on time. And thank you, my appreciations for being gone for testimony.
I'm sure you'll manage the flock of folks that come in, and it'll be interesting.
As long as they keep their demeanor at the middle school level, that's good.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, we will see you all as soon as the public testimony is over. You'll be back on.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, thank you very much. We're adjourned.
Thanks for asking. Again.
Do you have a second? Do you have a second?
Again.